KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We understand the frustration and your desire to see your homes firsthand, but until CAL FIRE tells us that the impacted areas are safe, we can't allow you to return.
Bracing for more high winds in Los Angeles, with two major fires burning for a full week now.
It is Tuesday, January 14th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As Los Angeles struggles to find some sense of normal, one puppet theater is offering families togetherness.
Puppet show in the big house, movies in the little house. We've got coloring books, and we're just doing anything we can to give people a little bit of a break.
Also, a new book makes the case against assimilation for the Asian diaspora in America.
A big part of the argument I make is to orient ourselves away from trying to prove ourselves to whiteness and to this country.
Those stories and more after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The death toll from the fires burning in Los Angeles has grown to at least 25. More than 100,000 people have been displaced, and many who fled the fires don't know if their homes are still standing. Today, federal officials opened disaster recovery sites in the area for fire victims to apply for federal grants and housing assistance. FEMA Administrator Bob Fenton.
One of the things that we've already done is had over 40,000 applications. We provided over $8 million. But there's a lot of work yet to do.
Winds are expected to pick up through tomorrow, and fire officials worry that bone-dry vegetation along with low humidity could spark new fires. Meanwhile, Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass says she has an open mind about working with the incoming Trump administration.
This is a crisis that impacts the nation. The nation's second largest city has got to succeed.
This after President-elect Trump accused her of incompetence over how she's handling the deadly wildfires. Defense Secretary-designate Pete Hegseth sat for his Senate confirmation hearing on Capitol Hill today. This amid intense criticism from Democrats for the military vet and former Fox host, ranking Armed Services Committee member Senator Jack Reed.
We must acknowledge the concerning public reports against you. A variety of sources, including your own writings, implicate you with disregarding the laws of war, financial mismanagement, racist and sexist remarks about men and women in uniform, alcohol abuse, sexual assault, sexual harassment, and other troubling issues.
But Hegseth says if confirmed, he won't drink, and he says he's the victim of a smear campaign by the media.
I'm not a perfect person, but redemption is real, and God forged me in ways that I know I'm prepared for.
Most Republicans defended him, while many Democrats focused on his conduct and whether he has the experience needed to lead the Pentagon, with some 3 million employees and nearly $850 billion budget. The SEC is suing Elon Musk, alleging he shortchanged investors when he took over Twitter. NPR's Bobby Allen has more.
Security regulators say when Musk was acquiring stock before he bought the platform now known as X, he was 11 days late in disclosing his stock purchases. Regulators say that delay effectively meant Musk bought stock at a discount and ripped off investors by more than $150 million. In a statement, Musk lawyer Alex Spiro says, quote, as the SEC retreats and leaves office, the SEC's multi-year campaign of harassment against Mr. Musk culminated in the filing of a single-count ticky-tack complaint. Musk, a close advisor to President-elect Donald Trump, is expected to attend Trump's inauguration on Monday. That will be when SEC Chair Gary Gensler steps down.
NPR's Bobby Allen reporting. You're listening to NPR News. Meta, the company that owns Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, says it's cutting 5% of its workforce in the latest round of layoffs that will be based on performance reviews. It's been a big week for Meta. Days ago, owner Mark Zuckerberg said he was getting rid of fact-checking and political content on Facebook amid other content moderation changes. Last week, Zuckerberg said the company was terminating its DEI programs. This week's Billboard charts are out, with two new albums battling it out for number one. And NPR's Stephen Thompson has more.
Two superstars put out new records in the opening days of 2025. Now they hold the top spots on the Billboard albums chart. The first is the rapper Lil Baby, whose new album Wham, that stands for Who Hard Is Me, dropped January 3rd.
She from up top where it's cold out. I call her pretty feet, she like to have her toes out.
Then there's Debí Tirar Más Fotos, the new album from Bad Bunny. It dropped on January 5th, 2 days after Lil Baby. In the end, Lil Baby had the top seller, Bad Bunny had the top streamer, and the upper hand went to Lil Baby. Bad Bunny had to settle for second place, at least for now. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
Kate Middleton says she's in remission from cancer months after the Princess of Wales finished chemotherapy. She wrote on Instagram, it's a relief and that she's focused on recovery. She revealed her cancer diagnosis without identifying what kind it was in a video last March. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California, where we are all bracing for a new round of high winds, just as firefighters continue battling against two major fires in Los Angeles that have been burning for a full week now. Officials are warning the risk of new fires is extremely high through tomorrow. We're joined now by NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles for more. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so it has been 7 days since these fires started tearing through L.A. As of now, where do things stand? Do you know?
Well, the two biggest fires, the Palisades fire on the west side and the Eaton fire on the east side, they are still raging and are only partially contained. But they are now burning in the unpopulated hills. There are about 9,000 firefighters working to extinguish them and to keep them away from residential areas. The next day and a half or so, Elsa, are going to be critical because those Santa Ana winds are blowing again, as you said. Those winds make it harder to keep the fires under control, and they also pose a huge risk of new fires. This is LA County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney earlier today.
The worst winds are predicted today for the late afternoon and into Wednesday. Please be assured that the Los Angeles County region is prepared.
Officials say that they have pre-positioned fire engines and firefighters all across the county so that new fires that do pop up can be quickly extinguished. But those winds do have everybody on pins and needles right now, wondering whether we will get through the next 36 hours without any new flare-ups.
Yeah, I've been stressed out all day. Can you just tell us what officials are specifically asking of people in the LA area?
Well, to stay alert for new evacuation warnings and to obey any new mandatory evacuation orders. They're also asking for people to understand that they may have to shut power off to prevent downed power lines from sparking new fires. And they're also asking unhoused people not to burn fires for warmth. Overnight temperatures are dipping into the 40s, and so they're asking folks to please seek warmth in shelters instead.
Yeah. Okay, well, I just want to ask you about the people who've had to evacuate already, because more than, 100,000 people were under mandatory evacuation orders. Now that these fires, as you say, now that they're mostly burning in unpopulated areas, are people being allowed to return home?
Some have had their evacuation orders lifted, but most, more than 80,000 people, have not. This is what LA Police Chief Jim McDonald said today. His officers are helping keep people out of areas that are off limits.
We understand the frustration and your desire to see your homes firsthand, but until CAL FIRE tells us that the impacted areas are safe for repopulation, we can't allow you to return.
You know, officials are going to reassess these neighborhoods' risk once the winds have passed.
Right. Okay, well, what about the many thousands of people whose homes have burned down? Like, what are you hearing about where people are staying? How are they managing?
Well, a lot of them are staying with family and friends or in temporary rentals or in Red Cross shelters. Wealthier folks, of course, are having an easier time than lower income people, you know, covering their costs. Yeah. At a donation center for people affected by the Eaton fire, our producer, Janaki Mehta, met Dora Abzun. She was picking up basic necessities.
Supplies for sleeping or towels or nothing. I don't have anything, nothing.
As her apartment was about to burn last week, Elsa, she rushed home to save her grandson's hamster.
And I ran in for saving his life, and I forgot everything. and I lost everything.
Wow. She's now searching for a new apartment, but that's something that's proving really hard for a lot of people and very expensive because tens of thousands of people are in the same situation.
And just very briefly, Adrian, what other kinds of assistance are available for people in need at the moment?
Well, those with insurance are beginning to file claims. FEMA also opened two disaster recovery centers today where people can seek financial and housing help. A lot of folks are leaning on friends and family. Some have opened GoFundMe campaigns, and there has been a huge outpouring of donations from across LA and beyond.
There has been so much community here. That is NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles. Thank you so much, Adrian.
You're welcome, Elsa.
For more than a decade, some 6 million Syrians fled the Assad regime for other countries. Now the opposite is happening. With the fall of that dictatorship last December, a new kind of refugee is fleeing Syria, those who sympathized with or even fought for the former regime. NPR's Emily Fang and Jawad Rizala met some of them across the Syrian border in Lebanon, where many are hiding.
The two Syrian families we meet here in northern Lebanon pour us tiny but strong glasses of herbal mata, a bitter tea beloved in their home country. One of the women, Ruba, says they left just one day before the Assad regime fell. Like many of the Syrians interviewed in this piece, she asks that we only use her first name to protect family who are still living in Syria. Ruba and her family paid smugglers $100 a head to bring them to a narrow river separating Syria from Lebanon. Where Ruba said she saw people of several sects flee, not just Alawites like her, an offshoot of Shia Muslims, which former Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad and his family also belong to, and whose adherents say they are experiencing an uptick in persecution under the new rebel government. The new leadership has dismissed such claims, but conceded there may be some revenge attacks. Ruba's brother-in-law, Abu Yaqub, interjects. The new government is not just Islamist, he says, they're extremists. There's no security anymore, Abu Yaqub continues. At least under the former dictator Bashar al-Assad, he says, there was security. His brother Abu Ali admits the Assads, accused of killing tens of thousands of their own people, were not perfect. But he says, at least under the Assads, you could imagine a future and come and go with security. He says the Syria he knew is gone. And now they are gone too. Part of an exodus of Syrians who had benefited under the old Assad regime and now have a lot to lose. Abu Ali's wife and relatives and many other newly minted Syrian refugees were smuggled through one Lebanese area called Wadi Khalid on the Syrian border. We meet the area's mayor, Sheikh Ahmed al-Sheikh. He estimates some 1,000 Syrians, somehow tied to the Assad regime, are being smuggled through his village every day. Via makeshift paths, his residents simply clear through the mountains with bulldozers. Also among those fleeing Syria now are some of the more than 200,000 people who fought for Assad's army, though many say they were forced to fight. We meet some of them at our final stop, at a Shiite shrine in Lebanon's Baqa Valley. The shrine is glittering, covered in turquoise and white tiles. Hundreds of people eat, sun, and pray here, and nearly all of them are Syrians. We head into the shrine's basement.
Normally this would be the mosque basement, and now it's just been subdivided by blankets into places where people can sleep.
They're mostly Syrian fighters with the Iran-backed group Hezbollah, who fought alongside Syria's army against the rebel groups now in power. The fighters say Hezbollah helped them cross into Lebanon and houses them in this shrine.
The fighters survive now in the shadows of the building, fed by a soup kitchen run by volunteers from Iran, a country which sponsored both the Assad regime and Hezbollah. Ibtissam, whom Holm says she left Syria because she was afraid the new government would kill her husband, a Hezbollah fighter. She forbade her teenage son from joining. Though her son, Rajab, whom Holm grins and says he'd join up if he could, he saw fighting for the Assad regime as a way to protect their village. A few rows away in the shrine basement, Ali Al-Ahmed, a 27-year-old Syrian Hezbollah sniper, says he joined Hezbollah when he was just 14 years old, in part because it paid far more than his Syrian army wage of $5 a month. When his unit heard that the Syrian government was crumbling, his Hezbollah commander told him to flee. Al-Ahmed says he dug a hole in the ground. Inside it, he buried one of his guns, then threw his sniper rifle in the trash. He burned his Syrian military uniform and fled to Lebanon. Holding his young daughter as he speaks to us, he says he was prepared to die fighting Syria's rebels. His side lost. But if he gets the call to fight again with Hezbollah, he says he would heed it. Emily Fang, NPR News, the Bekaa Valley, Lebanon.
Astronomers are having a big meeting in Maryland this week. They're discussing lots of cosmic goodies that the James Webb Space Telescope has found. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, some of the strangest celestial objects are known as little red dots.
Little red dots were spotted by the James Webb Space Telescope just after it started operating in 2022. Like the name suggests, little red dots are compact objects far smaller than our own Milky Way galaxy. And they're reddish in color, though their light has unusual features that astronomers struggle to explain.
There's a lot of intrigue about exactly what's going on.
Dale Kosevsky is an astrophysicist at Colby College. He and some colleagues have now used the telescope's data to study over 300 little red dots.
We found out that they essentially only appear in the early universe. They essentially, all of them exist back when the universe was a billion years old or younger.
As the universe ages, they disappear. Or maybe their appearance changes. His team found evidence that a large fraction of little red dots contain signs of a black hole. So, he says,
it could be that we're seeing the formation of the cores of today's massive galaxies.
Because today, almost all large galaxies have a central black hole. All of this is being hotly debated, though, at the American Astronomical Society meeting. Not every astronomer thinks you need a big black hole to explain a little red dot. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. I grew up in Silicon Valley in the 80s and 90s. There were already a ton of Asians in the area. There are even more these days. And I didn't process until years later how special growing up like that is in America, when you're not white, but you're surrounded by people who look like you. So you can sort of insulate yourself from feelings of exclusion because you don't feel all that different day to day. Our next guest grew up in an area with an even higher concentration of Asians, San Gabriel Valley, right outside LA. It's a place that forms the starting point for her new book called Unassimilable. It argues the case against assimilation for the Asian diaspora and reimagines where to find community in this country. Bianca Mabute-Louis joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
We're so glad to have you. So you describe San Gabriel Valley as a place, quote, where Asian immigrants go to never assimilate. What do you mean by that? Because, I mean, for people who've never been to SGV, what does it feel like to live there?
Yeah, what I mean by that is if you are a Chinese immigrant, you can navigate San Gabriel Valley without ever really learning English, continuing to have access to the foods you're comfortable with, finding people from your own community to work with and build community with. And so I start the book with the ethnoburb and specifically a story of my popo, my grandma on my maternal side, who experienced just that. She immigrated later in her life in her 70s. And because of the ethnoburb, she was able to have this vibrant third act without needing to learn a new language or assimilate or acclimate to a new country.
Right. I mean, she could stay in her Cantonese bubble. She never learned English. What did you make of that as a child, like watching her curate her own world like that?
Oh, as a child, I was horrified because here I am, right? I'm second generation, a child of immigrants. I lived in the ethnoburb where I was surrounded by people like me. But still, as a child of immigrants, you feel, at least in the 90s, you feel the compulsory normativity of whiteness. I still, you know, only saw white people on TV. Where I went to school was a predominantly white area. And so my popo refusing to assimilate really threatened my compulsion to try to blend in and belong.
But I want to make sure I understand the case that you lay out in this book for not assimilating. You write that, quote, unassimilability is a proposition to refuse to belong here altogether, together. Unassimilability frees us to define ourselves, our belonging, and our power independent of whiteness. So my question for you is, what does not assimilating look like day to day? Because we can't all live in San Gabriel Valley like your popo.
Yeah, I think a big part of the argument I make in Unassimilable is to orient ourselves away from trying to prove ourselves to whiteness and to this country, and to orient ourselves towards community.
Yeah, but I guess I want to understand, what does orienting ourselves towards each other mean? Like, who is the each other? Like, my lingering thought, Bianca, is I still do want to belong here in America. And to me, belonging in America is not only shaped by whiteness, but it's also shaped by colliding and mixing with all the cultures that make America, not just white cultures. And I have trouble picturing being both Asian and American outside of that collision and mixing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the book isn't an argument to be isolationist, right? But I think, you know, what it means and how we can apply it more broadly to society and to our lives, no matter where we live, is thinking about how to build community outside of the institutions and norms that the state kind of defines for us. And so one example of how I'm trying to pursue that in my current stage of life, I'm not in an ethnoburb, I'm actually in the South. And so what that has looked like for me is joining political community, joining mutual aid organizations with people who are most impacted. And I'm not really thinking about if they're Asian or not Asian. I'm just thinking about who's impacted when the hurricane comes. Who am I going to call? I always make the joke, who's going to be on my compound when the apocalypse comes? Because that's who I'm building community with. And that's what it means for me to be unassimilable.
When I think about creating community, though, and claiming my heritage. I mean, when I was reading your book, I did wonder to myself, man, like, am I not angry enough as an Asian American? Like, should I, claiming my heritage, claiming community, be more adversarial to whiteness?
In the book, I do position it as adversarial to whiteness because—
You do?
Yeah, because I see how often we try to claim community and belonging in alignment with whiteness. I think about the spike in anti-Asian hate crimes as a result of COVID-19, how so many folks were trying to, you know, argue that we are from here and so we don't deserve to be treated like this. But it just made me think, like, no one deserves to be treated like this. And actually, it shines a light on how this country treats people, and that we are not immune because we've been stereotyped as the model minority. And so I think that's why I take, you know, what you call an adversarial approach, because it was around that time when I thought, I don't want to belong here. I don't want to build belonging around what this country claims to be, because I think this country is lying to me, right? This is, you know, a country built on genocide and enslavement. Is this really something I want to belong to? And if no, what and who do I want to belong to?
I know that you wrote much of this book while pregnant, and very fittingly, your son has two beautiful names that reflect so much of what is in this book, a Chinese name and a Filipino name. Can you tell us both of those names and what they mean?
Yeah. His Filipino name is Kapwa, which means you are my other me, or it points to our interconnectedness. And his Chinese name is Gayin, which my mom gave him that name, and it means to take an expansive view of family. But it also has a double meaning, which is to kind of embody this indomitable spirit.
Who do you hope your son will eventually find family and belonging with someday?
I hope he finds family and belonging with the masses of people that are oppressed by our structures. I think going through writing this book was kind of, in some ways, the end of identity politics for me, even though it is a book about the Asian diaspora. So I realize that's kind of ironic. But, you know, by the end of writing this book, I was like, this politic of unassimilability leads me to this place of feeling an urgent and necessary solidarity with all people all over the world who are oppressed by these structures of white supremacy and violence and settler colonialism. And so I hope that, you know, my child would feel also that urgent solidarity that not only moves him to action, but connects him to the hope of communities actually taking action and pushing back against oppression.
Bianca Mabute-Louis' new book is called Unassimilable, an Asian Diasporic Manifesto for the 21st Century. Thank you very much, Bianca.
Thank you so much, Elsa. I really enjoyed this chat with you.
This is NPR News.
Some of President-elect Trump's cabinet choices face stiff opposition. Marco Rubio is a little different. A veteran senator, former presidential candidate, former critic of President-elect Trump, who came to agree with many of his foreign policy views. Rubio's path to the State Department tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A new hospital program considers the role of spirituality as part of patient care.
It's pairing patients with local faith groups to address loneliness.
Patients will say the most important part of their health journey is their provider, and second is their faith.
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The first day of confirmation hearings for the president-elect's pick to lead the Pentagon was marked by a series of heated exchanges. Pete Hegseth, an Army veteran and former Fox News host, faced a tough round of questioning from the Senate Armed Services Committee about his qualifications to fill the role. Lawmakers also confronted Hegseth about allegations of excessive drinking and sexual assault.
Why do they want to destroy me? Because I'm a change agent and a threat to them, because Donald Trump was willing to choose me, to empower me, to bring the Defense Department back to what it really should be, which is warfighting.
Hegseth also dodged repeated questions about whether he would stand up to Donald Trump if the president requested an illegal order. The Alabama NAACP is filing a federal lawsuit challenging a state law barring diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and curriculum. Kelsey Shelton from member station WBHM reports the plaintiffs argue the law violates their First and 14th Amendment rights by restricting what students can learn and by discriminating on the basis of race.
The law prohibits universities, K-12 school systems, and state agencies from sponsoring DEI programs. Teachers can be penalized for teaching divisive concepts. University of Alabama at Birmingham student Sydney Tessman says the law is decreasing access to identity-based scholarships, like one made possible through the university's Black fraternities and sororities.
And we make it a big event, a step show, and a scholarship goes to an African-American student each year. We are now no longer able to do that.
Governor Kay Ivey's office said in an email to WBHM that the governor stands behind the intent of the legislation. For NPR News, I'm Kelsey Shelton in Birmingham.
This is NPR News in Washington. An international committee of experts is recommending a change to the way obesity is defined and diagnosed. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the aim is to provide a more accurate way of measuring body fat.
Obesity has long been diagnosed by calculating a person's BMI, which is a quick and inexpensive estimate based on just weight and height. But Dr. Robert Kushner of Northwestern University, who was part of the commission, says not everyone with a high BMI has excess body fat.
We try to define obesity by excess body fat, which is what obesity actually is.
The commission recommends adding other measures, such as waist circumference or waist-to-hip ratio, or using direct measures of body fat to diagnose obesity. By doing so, an athlete with lots of muscle mass who may have a high BMI but low body fat would not be considered obese. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Britain's Princess of Wales has announced that her cancer is in remission. Princess Kate released a statement on social media today after visiting patients at the hospital where she was treated last year. The princess had disclosed her cancer diagnosis 6 weeks after her father-in-law, King Charles, revealed that he had also been diagnosed with cancer. Neither has specified the type of cancer. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday, With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Early this morning, special counsel Jack Smith closed the book on his election interference charges against Donald Trump. Smith says that criminal case would have produced a conviction against Trump, but for Trump's return to the White House this year. Smith also defended his work against accusations that he acted with politics in mind. He said he and his team followed one North Star, the facts, wherever they led. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson has been poring over the 174 pages of the report. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Mary Louise.
That's an awfully confident assessment that he says this would have produced a conviction against Trump. What was the evidence that gave him so much confidence that he could get a conviction on four felony counts?
Jack Smith outlined a pervasive pattern of deceit about the 2020 election. He talked about doing interviews with aides and Trump family members that suggest Donald Trump said one thing in public about election fraud and another in private. And Smith mentioned a November 2020 comment Trump allegedly made after watching Joe Biden on TV, basically saying, "Can you believe I lost to this guy?" Smith also said it was foreseeable that violence would happen at the Capitol on January 6, 2021, and that Trump took advantage of it. He refused to call off the mob for hours and actually said, "So what?" when Trump learned Mike Pence was in danger there. And the prosecutors say they would have convicted him if a trial was allowed to happen, but ultimately that won't happen because of a longstanding Justice Department policy that sitting presidents cannot be charged or tried for crimes.
And the backdrop is that Jack Smith has resigned. He's dropped his cases. So the basic question, but why does this report matter at this point?
This was really a chance for prosecutors to explain what they did and why. In large part, they're writing for history at a time when Donald Trump and many Republican lawmakers have been calling the rioters hostages and patriots. Smith also got a chance to respond to criticism about possible delay in the Justice Department case. He said some of that is because Trump fought so hard over executive privilege, which took months and months, and that the Supreme Court took a long time to both accept this case over whether Trump had immunity and then to decide it. And the prosecutors also said they had a harder job than the House January 6th committee did because they had a higher bar to meet. Finally, we learned from this report that prosecutors considered charging Trump with insurrection, which could have disqualified him from running for office, but hardly anyone has been charged with that crime for decades. And they also considered charging him with incitement for comments that he made at the rally before the mob descended on the Capitol, but that's a really high legal bar and they didn't meet it.
Yeah. Well, I will note Trump fought until the last hour. He was fighting still last night to block the report's release. Now that it is out, we can read it. Is this the end of all of the trials that President-elect Trump was facing?
The criminal trials, I think largely yes, but the former president and president-elect still faces civil claims from some of the 140 law enforcement officers who were brutalized at the Capitol with things like flagpoles and bear spray. And prosecutions may actually continue at the state level for some of Trump's alleged co-conspirators.
Oh, stay with them for a second. The alleged co-conspirators. These are people like Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman. You were talking about state charges. What about federal cases against them?
Neither of those attorneys has been charged with a federal crime. Jack Smith says his team had made some preliminary decisions about charging other people and whether to try them alongside Donald Trump or separately. That work's over now, though, and it's hard to imagine the Trump Justice Department would take up any of those cases. In fact, it's far more likely Trump will pardon many of those at the Capitol as soon as next week when he's inaugurated.
And Carrie, last thing, Jack Smith had two cases against Trump. The other one was the classified documents case at Mar-a-Lago. What happens to that case now?
You know, the Justice Department is trying to keep alive the case against Trump's co-defendants there. Those are longtime Mar-a-Lago aides Walt Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira. It's still an open question whether we're going to see Volume 2 of Jack Smith's report, and that focuses on the highly classified materials the FBI found in Trump's home and in ballrooms and bathrooms in Florida. Florida Judge Eileen Cannon, who was appointed to the bench by Donald Trump, has called for a hearing on releasing that part of the Smith report in Florida this Friday.
NPR's Carrie Johnson, thank you.
My pleasure.
As Angelenos wade through their losses from the historic fires in the L.A. area, parents and kids are having a hard time finding some sense of normalcy. Between many schools that are still closed and businesses trying to reopen, communities here are trying to find moments of togetherness, respite, and some joy. Moments that include a singing and dancing puppet named Yellow Cat. NPR's Janaki Mehta has this story.
Dozens of kids are sitting on a carpeted floor drizzled with popcorn at Vidyard's, a historic community theater in Northeast LA. The children and their families are wrapped as Yellow Cat sways, twirls, and prances in the confident hands of puppeteer Diego Montoya.
The show was planned just as a way to give families an opportunity to do something that's fun and silly and get away from the chaos of the world right now.
Montoya normally works down the road at Bob Baker Marionette Theater, which joined forces with Vidyard's for this free event, and says it's no accident that Yellow Cat is dancing to Barbara Streisand's Don't Rain on My Parade.
Don't Rain on My Parade. I'm gonna have fun no matter what. I'm gonna do what brings me joy.
We've got puppet show in the big house, movies in the little house. We've got pajamas we're giving out. We've got coloring books and... we're just doing anything we can to give people a little bit of a break.
Maggie McKay is the executive director of Vidyard's and says many people in the surrounding community who've come in have lost their homes. Several kids here have also lost schools to the fires that are still burning across LA.
So it's been a really stressful and emotional week.
The Eaton Fire on the east side of LA consumed parts of the school Tanya Verifield's son went to. So this is a welcome distraction for her three-year-old Leo.
I think this is the only 2 hours I haven't been constantly checking my phone and trying to get updates. And I feel just some relief at watching my son giggle and watch, you know, these amazing puppets and this magic show and just feeling really, really fortunate.
Another mom, Kate Maller, has two young kids. Both their schools also suffered severe damage, and she says she's been single parenting for days now.
It's been so beautiful to see other moms here and to see our classmates and be able to hug.
Also getting lots of unsolicited hugs from tiny people in the lobby is a 6-foot-tall giraffe named Jeffrey. Real name, Nathan Hernandez.
I live all the way in Riverside, but I just wanted to come out of my way to hopefully make parents and kids happy with this outfit here.
There were lots of happy parents and kids, even among those for whom normal life is pretty far away right now. And as the puppet show wrapped up, I caught up with 5-year-old Iris Wong to get her review.
How do I explain this?
What was your favorite puppet today?
The Yellow Cat. Yeah, it's like a big special finale.
Janaki Mehta, NPR News, Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Today is the first day of the legislative session for Minnesota lawmakers. This is usually a day when Democratic Governor Tim Walz hands out baked goods to Democrats and Republicans in a show of bipartisanship. But the baked goods were not there today, and neither were any of the Democrats in the state House of Representatives. That is because they walked out over a power dispute with Republicans. Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters has this story on what happened next.
I'm walking through the Minnesota State Capitol on the opening day of its legislative session. Lobbyists are starting to show up. TV cameras are being set up. Activists are putting up displays ready to advocate for their causes. It's a lot of the usual annual sights and sounds. But inside the Minnesota House of Representatives, though?
There being 67 members present, there is no quorum as required by the Constitution of the State of Minnesota.
Mr. Secretary?
The House may not conduct any further business, and the House of Representatives is adjourned.
That's Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon, a Democrat who presided over the chamber, saying basically there's not enough people here to get anything done. Voters in November elected a split Minnesota House, 67 Democrats and 67 Republicans. There were talks of power sharing among the party leaders, but then a Democrat wound up not taking his seat after a judge said he wasn't honest about living within the district. That gave Republicans a one-seat edge ahead of a special election later this month. All right, back in the House chamber, the Secretary of State steps aside and Republicans take things over, electing their leader, Lisa Damith, the Speaker of the House, despite not having a quorum. Damith gives an acceptance speech.
The Minnesota people are counting on us today, not for partisan victories or for political theater, but for real results that improve their daily lives.
The Democratic leader in that chamber, Melissa Hortman, wasn't even at the Capitol today and doesn't sound like her caucus will be showing up anytime soon.
We do not intend to return to the Capitol and participate in any sham proceedings.
Hortman says her members will be meeting with constituents in their districts. The House seat that's going before a special election has historically been a safe one for Democrats. Hortman says what happens in the days to come at the Capitol is meaningless.
They clearly lost on quorum and they just couldn't handle it. So they had to have a fake House of Representatives. It is really astonishing that they would take it to that extent.
Hortman was Speaker of the House for 6 years. The last two, Democrats had complete control of state government here. So she's fully aware of the power of the Speaker position. They're concerned Republicans will try to block another Democrat who was reelected by just 14 votes from taking his seat. To make things more complicated, in the state Senate, there's also a temporary tie following the death of one of its members. But in that chamber, Republicans and Democrats are working together until the seat is filled later this month. Democratic Senate Leader Erin Murphy is staying out of the House drama.
I have confidence that the House is going to eventually come together and we'll do our work in short order.
Somewhere in the next few months, lawmakers will have to pass a budget to keep the government open in the North Star State. Also absent from the first day, Democratic Governor Tim Walz, the unsuccessful vice presidential candidate, is back in his state and will have his budget blueprint in as soon as later this week, no matter who is walking these halls. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Plenty of exercise, a balanced diet, staying on top of your prescriptions. These are all key ingredients to good health, right? But what about spirituality, feelings of purpose, connections to something bigger than yourself, or a general sense of community? Well, Ben Thorpe of Side Effects Public Media spoke with health experts who say that spiritual support should be a part of hospital care, and they have piloted a unique program to help do just that.
Timothy Moss has been struggling with feelings of extreme loneliness. At 59, he was forced to retire from his job teaching gifted students at a school in Terre Haute, Indiana, because of struggles with his health.
I had to retire early, so I had to quit teaching, and that was the love of my life. Sorry.
Moss loved the school. It was more than a job to him.
I loved it. That was my hobby. It was all my friendships.
Moss struggles with a variety of physical ailments, including diabetes, neuropathy, heart problems, and vision issues, which eventually forced him to retire. Moss, who says he spent much of his life at the school, found himself cut off from that world and the teachers he had been close to.
So I lost my social group, and, they're all busy working and doing things, and so it was just a new chapter where my life really, it just changed abruptly. It slowed down.
More recently, Moss's brother passed, further cutting him off from social connections.
When you're in your senior years, you're kind of forgotten, you know, because things change in your life and you feel like, oh my gosh, you don't have the purpose you used to have.
When Moss's struggles were identified by his doctor, he was connected to a unique program within the Indiana University Health System called the Congregational Care Network. That program pairs patients with so-called connectors, members of local faith groups who spend time with patients over a 12-week period.
Patients will say the most important part of their health journey is their provider, and second is their faith.
This is Jay Foster. He's the vice president of spiritual care at IU and says their program begins with a doctor asking patients a series of so-called spiritual assessment questions to identify if they need something beyond their immediate physical care.
All human beings have a need for meaning and purpose. When someone has an illness, that sense of meaning and purpose is impinged upon, and having a thoughtful conversation partner can help people cope with that illness.
To get that conversation started, doctors will ask a range of questions, including how lonely are you, to is your faith an important resource in times of illness. Foster is quick to explain that spirituality isn't exclusive to religious groups, but religious groups often have built-in social networks that individuals and healthcare systems can tap into for help.
With the ultimate goal of helping that individual find a community that's meaningful for them, so that they are not only a patient, but as a member of the community, they're not just receiving care, they're actually contributing.
One of the churches working with the IU Health System in Indianapolis is First Friends Quaker Meeting. Kathy Ryan is a member who started speaking with a woman in palliative care connected to her through the hospital.
We talked about everything, our entire lives, and have just become fast friends. And now she calls me and I call her, and we're like sisters, is how it feels.
Ryan comes from a different faith tradition than the patient she connects with, who was raised Jewish. But to Ryan, those differences don't matter.
For the Quakers, all are welcome. And it's really important. I think the more we reach out, the better the opportunity that someone find a community and feel loved and feel cared for.
Ryan's relationship with her patient extended beyond the initial 12 weeks allotted for the program. She says once they grew close, it felt like there was no reason to stop talking. It's an experience administrators of the program say is not at all uncommon.
And I think her just knowing that there's someone that she could call if she were afraid means the world to me and means the world to her. And it goes both ways.
Health experts say the IU Health program is part of an effort to better integrate so-called spiritual care into patient care for people struggling with illness or loneliness, and it starts at the hospital. Daniel Solmacy is the director of the Kennedy School of Ethics at Georgetown University. He says asking about a patient's spirituality can still be uncomfortable.
We've been able to overcome taboos and talk about patients' sexual activities, their drug use, but somehow we've not been able to ask them about their own spiritual beliefs and practices that can really impact their own care.
Solmacy says programs like the one at IU are still rare, but may represent early efforts to bring spiritual care, or as he describes it, whole person care, back into the doctor's office. And there are signs that conversations are being had. At the most recent annual meeting of the American Medical Association, delegates passed a resolution both promoting medical education on spiritual health and supporting patient access to spiritual care services. Solmacy says there is still some hesitancy from physicians to ask patients questions about their spiritual needs.
I don't want to advocate that physicians should become the spiritual friend of their patients or to become the patient's chaplain, but quite often they might be the only people who really ask the questions.
Skeptics argue that programs like the one at Indiana University Health require investment in preventative care not normally supported by hospital systems. But advocates say those questions increase patient satisfaction with their healthcare experience. Timothy Moss, after speaking with his doctor about the program, was paired with a member of a Methodist church in Bloomington, some 60 miles away. Moss, the retired teacher, says his overall health hasn't been improving in the way he's wanted it to, and he still struggles. But the conversations with his connector, Janet, have helped him manage.
That's what I found is, you know, a lot of times when I'm talking with Janet and she's helping me through things that I'm trying to manage along with my health issues, it's just nice to have someone to be able to discuss and share with.
Like connector Kathy Ryan, Moss says his time in the program with Janet has already gone for the required 12 weeks. But, he says, they're still talking on a regular basis. For NPR News, I'm Ben Thorpe.
Side Effects Public Media is a health reporting collaboration of NPR member stations across the Midwest. It's based at WFYI in Indianapolis.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement designed by gastroenterologists to help relieve occasional bloating, gas, and abdominal discomfort. More at alignprobiotics.com.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet. Ain't no hope.